Saturday night. How does that work? It's not, but next week is I don't call it Easter, I call it Resurrection Sunday. It seems like Easter represents a religious holiday, and we're not just talking about a religious holiday. We are talking about a real live event in history. It really did happen. And this week I want to talk about why I think it happened. And I'm just curious, how many of you have heard of the Resurrection Creed? Good, because I made it up. If anybody would have raised their hand, I would have, you have, huh? Now, if you Google it, you might actually come up with something. And maybe they think it's the same thing I am. But it's not actually called this. I just thought it was, since it's the resurrection, it seems like a good terminology to use. Actually, you'll see why I think it fits, though. Now, years before the New Testament was written, the gospel was preached. So it was proclaimed. So you had the event of the resurrection, but they didn't turn right around and start writing it out the next day, right? But the apostles started to proclaim the message of the resurrection right away. And we call this the oral gospel. So they actually did this orally. They preached orally. And the idea of a creed is that it's a Latin term, and it means that I believe. And so the resurrection creed would have been the proclamation that I believe the resurrection. Now, I believe personally that this creed that I'm going to get into is the most powerful and most significant tangible evidence that we have that points to the validity of the resurrection. However, it really only will make sense to you if you follow closely, every ear closely listening to I want you hanging on every word that I say. But truthfully, it can get a little confusing, so try to stick with it and follow why, because as we put it together, it'll make more and more sense. At first, it might just seem like, okay, what is that? How does that prove anything? But if you really follow along closely, you can see how powerful this argument becomes. Now, back in January, I spoke on the evidence of the resurrection based on the apostles' blood testimony. And I don't know if you made it. It was, you know, on Sunday, it was a big snowstorm. It wasn't, I don't think, the Saturday night. But if you didn't get a chance to hear this, I wanted to mention it because it follows in this same vein, talking about the resurrection. And I talked about the apostles and how they died and how their death and their willingness to be executed for their faith demonstrated proof for what it is that they were proclaiming, which was the resurrection. If you want to hear this, I have it. It's not just on tape. We do have it on tape, but I also added the slides to it and made a video. And so if you want to access that after the service, let me know. And I have little slips of paper so you can know where to go on the web and watch a video of what I spoke on back in January. Okay, I want to get into the credibility and the testimony of the resurrection creed. The credibility, really, mostly, if we go back to that apostles' blood testimony, we have this an amazing amount of credibility because they died for their faith, and we went through how strong that was. This week, I want to go through the testimony, which it was that they died for, and how we know what it was exactly that they were proclaiming. Because there are skeptics out there that will tell you they died for their faith, it's just that the Bible doesn't represent what they had to say. And that is the skeptic's argument, okay? They actually don't say that the apostles were just a fraud. They don't say that. They say the apostles were real people. It's just that we just don't have what they wrote. We don't know what they wrote. We're not sure, okay? And so what I want to get in today is to show you the evidence behind, oh, yes, we do know what they had to say and how we know what that is. I want to ask you a question. Is it circular reasoning to use the Bible to prove the resurrection? Seems like it might be, huh? However, let me ask another question. Is it circular reasoning to use a birth certificate to prove when you were born? Well, no, of course not, right? So if one's true, then why isn't the other true? I think they're both the same thing. Because the issue that comes up with circular reasoning is when people use the Bible to prove the Bible. Okay? I would agree that's circular reasoning. That's not what I'm trying to do here this today. What I'm doing is I'm going to use the Bible as a source to point to an event in history, the resurrection. So I'm not using the Bible to prove the Bible, but I also don't want us to dismiss the Bible as a source to prove the resurrection, because it indeed is our best source. We have, and the Bible doesn't come to us just as a big book. It actually is written in different books. It was letters, it was poems, it was lots of things, and it's all been compiled into a single book, okay? So let's think of it more that way. So then let's think about how do the skeptics then view the New Testament and the Apostle Paul? Well, let's first of all, I want to explain that the skeptics, believe it or not, as much as we sometimes think they do, and when I say skeptics, I'm not talking about you're the guy on the street that doesn't know anything and says, I just don't believe none of that junk. Okay, that's not what I mean by a skeptic. What I mean by a skeptic are people that have dedicated a major amount of time studying, scholars who study, but for whatever reason, they don't wind up believers. Okay, that's the kind of skeptic I'm talking about. Those kind of skeptics actually do put a lot of credence in the Bible. Okay, they will not say it's just something you throw out. They won't say that at all. The thing that they don't agree with is that a resurrection actually occurred. That is what they don't agree with. But what they do agree with is that the Bible is a source, and it is a multiple source of multiple books, multiple letters, and that these things can be used to try to understand what happened in history, just like anything else in history. Now, I want to go over what skeptics agree about the New Testament, and that is that we have an accurate representation of the original writings. And they think that when we look at the Bible, the Bible is written over and is not translated, but it was copied and copied and copied and copied, so we don't know what we have. Okay, now the fact is we have 5,800 manuscripts that are Greek and over 20,000 manuscripts altogether in different languages that all date back in the first couple centuries. So we have an amazing amount of credible information that tells us that we know what we have. And the skeptics agree. Okay, that's the point. And so I don't want to get into the we could talk a long time to prove this, but I want you to know the skeptics agree. They all do. They say, yes, yes. We don't need to go there anymore. We agree. What we have now very well represents what took place, or they won't necessarily agree in all the events that took place, but they'll agree that what was written matches what we have today. Next point I want to make is that, and I'm going to use the Wikipedia to prove just how true this is. So this comes right out of Wikipedia. It says that these are the seven letters, and then there's consensus dates, considered genuine by most scholars. Okay, so again, when they say most scholars, that means the critics. That means the people that do not believe in a resurrection, for example. Okay, now they have a lot of skepticism about different books in the Bibles, but one of the ones that they hold most dear that the skeptics love are Paul's letters. And one of the reasons is that Paul's letters It's discourse between a church and him, and he's writing, and he explains problems, and he talks about different events that are taking place, which is very different than when you're writing a book like one of the Gospels, where you're kind of, it's more like you're documenting what you believe, okay? The letters aren't like that. He's writing, and he's saying, I, Paul, and he's saying, you guys in Corinth, and then he tells them what he's thinking about what they're doing, okay? Well, the skeptics love that because they say, well, I'm not saying they love it because of what it says in it, but they say, you know, what can you say? This is real stuff. He opens up almost every book and says, I, Paul, so you know who wrote it. See, a lot of books you don't know for sure. I, Paul, to the Corinthians, so you know who you wrote it to. Then he goes into his explanation. And what we find is that even the skeptics would say that all of these books here, these are the highest ranked books. And so what I want to do as I seek to give us evidence for the resurrection is use the books that even the skeptics would agree are legitimate books to use to understand what happened in history. Next, I want to point out that Paul is an independent source that is fair to use as we try to figure this out. Again, as I started in the beginning and I said, well, are we using the Bible to prove the Bible? Is it circular reasoning? That kind of thing. Okay, no, again, we're using Paul's letters, which we have multiple letters, to understand what happened that in an event that he was very close to. And we're using letters to go over that, again, that even the skeptics would agree. Now, these facts that I want to hit real quick are not even questioned by the skeptics. They would give them to you and say, oh, yes, that's absolutely true. They would say that, yes, Paul was a Pharisee who despised Jesus and the Christian faith. So that is considered accepted by everybody. That really, there was a real guy named Paul, and he really did persecute the early church. He was a Pharisee, and that's what he did. And he did that persecution harshly. Paul converted about 2 years. I'm going to give you all of the, I decided when I give all these dates, I'm just going to give you a number. Understand that there's a little fudge in all that, meaning it could go either way, plus or minus at least one, sometimes more. Most of the numbers I'm going to give tonight are within just a couple years, though. Okay, so they're all very close to being, there's a lot of evidence that points to these dates, but I'm just going to give you a single number. So Paul was converted about 2 years after the crucifixion took place. And so bear in mind that he then was not a friend of the disciples. So there's no connection with Paul and the disciples. Totally different. So the disciples that were with Christ all together, because I just don't know if you've been in church much, but if you haven't, what you find is that Paul is this way over here, and we have the 12 apostles over here. And so there was no collusion. You know, if that argument comes up, well, if Paul worked with the apostles, no, there's no way. He was actually persecuting these guys, and they were afraid for their life from this guy Paul. Okay, so there was no collusion going on there. And Paul did not meet any apostles at all until probably 5 years after the resurrection. At least we show no evidence that he did, and in fact we show a lot of evidence that he didn't meet any of the apostles until 5 years after the resurrection. Then Paul writes about his conversion several times. He writes about it in Galatians, in Corinthians, and in Philippians. So we have plenty of his personal testimony explaining his conversion. And then in Acts, Luke, who wrote Acts, gives an account of the testimony that Paul gave to King Agrippa. And I want to read that. It's very significant, and it gives a quick overview of the situation Paul was in. Excuse me. First of all, his conversion took place shortly after being... I have to get a drink. His conversion took place shortly after being confronted by Jesus on the road to Damascus. in AD 32 that took place. So in Acts 26, it goes like this. So, of course, I myself was convinced that it was necessary to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus the Nazarene. And that is what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prisons by the authority I received from the chief priests, but I also cast my vote against them when they were sentenced to death. I punished them often in all the synagogues and tried to force them to blaspheme. Because I was so furiously enraged at them, I went to persecute them even in foreign cities. While doing this very thing, as I was going to Damascus with authority and complete power from the chief priests, about noon along the road, Your Majesty, he's talking to King Agrippa, Your Majesty, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, shining everywhere around me and those traveling with me. When we had fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in Aramaic, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? You are hurting yourself by kicking against the goads." So I said, "Who are you, Lord?" And the Lord replied, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." Now, when we hear this story, and again, Paul gives an account that's not as extended. That's why I give you this one. In three of his books, so we know that he testifies that this took place. Do you think it's reasonable to think that Paul might be lying? Does this seem like maybe it's a story that is just being made up? And if you do, I want you to consider what goes on in 2 Corinthians 11:24. And let's just read just how much persecution Paul went through in order to follow Christ. In 2 Corinthians 11:24, it says, "Five times I received from the Jews 40 lashes less one. Three times I was beaten with a rod. Once I received a stoning. Three times I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I spent adrift in the open sea. I have been on journeys many times, in dangers from rivers, in dangers from robbers, in dangers from my own countrymen, in dangers from Gentiles, in dangers in the city, in dangers in the wilderness, in dangers at sea, in dangers from false brothers, in hard work and toil, through many sleepless nights, in hunger and thirst, many times without food and cold and without enough clothing." Paul went through more suffering and persecution than probably anybody that we find in all of the Bible. Paul was somebody who endured persecution. Does that raise his credibility? Huge to me. I don't know anybody, again, that would endure this kind of persecution for a lie. It doesn't make sense. And then we go on to Philippians 1:20. And listen to what he says there. He says, "My confident hope is that I will in no way be ashamed, but that with complete boldness, even now as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, whether I live or die, for to me living is Christ, and dying is gain." Again, does that make Paul more credible, making these kinds of statements? I believe so. Not only making these statements, but he's saying that he's willing to die. He backs it up, though, with a life full of persecution. And in the end, Paul is executed in Rome in AD 67 at the hands of Nero. Now, last time in January, I explained a little bit about what happened in this time with Nero persecuting the Christians, and they gave Christians a chance to get out. Okay, the Christians had to decide, no, we would rather hold on to our faith and be executed and not deny Christ. And they had that option. Okay, so Paul, again, went through the most persecution and then allowed himself to be executed. I consider Paul an excellent source, credible, along with the 12 that we talked about before, a blood testimony. Paul also has a blood testimony. So then I want to look at the joint blood testimony between of the 12 along with Paul. And again, it strengthens when you think about the fact that that they didn't know each other, and yet they were all willing to die for the same cause. How does that happen? How could you not be, you're a persecutor, persecuting the 12, and yet you get converted, but we show in Scripture that they don't know each other. When we try to figure out what motive the 12 had, we can't come up with a good motive because they didn't get rich, they all died, they all were persecuted, they were executed, all but one. It makes no sense. Well, it even makes less sense to try to figure out why Paul would want to join these guys who are being persecuted, and he knows how much because he's the one doing it, and there's others, so he knows what's going on. Why would he join them, and how would you join them? Hey, guys, I'd like to be part of your persecution. Instead of persecuting, I want to join you and be persecuted. And these guys are going to accept that? Sure, come on and join us. And wouldn't Paul know their line? I mean, if anybody knows lying, it would be Paul. And yet, he didn't figure out them to be a lie. He decided they were telling the truth. The persecuted decided they're telling the truth. They also had to believe Paul, which is interesting. Because, oh, sure you are. You know, there's a lot going on there when you think about how does that work that this joined up? The more I thought about it, the harder it gets. I don't even know a good story to make up how these guys all got together. Except that I believe it really happened. That Paul truly did face Jesus. And when he started preaching, it truly was so sincere that they figured out this is the real deal. And so they brought him in. So in 1 Corinthians 15, now I finally want to get to the creed. And all this was to back up just how credible the testimony is of Paul as he gives us this creed in 1 Corinthians 15, starting with verse 3. It says, "For I passed unto you as of first importance what I also received." Okay? So this is it. This is the creed coming up. "That Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas." I'm sorry, I lost my place. "And they appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Okay, so now you'll notice that I got some color coding up there. And that's so that we get an idea why scholars all think that this is a creed. First of all, this follows the format of what creeds look like at that time. When they did a creed, they would do the "that," which in Greek is a hati. They set it up, it's kind of like a parenthesis, "that." So you see these that Christ died for our sins, that he was buried, that he was raised. Okay, so they're setting it, it's a formatting that they do. Also, you see the according to the scriptures. Okay, and that was because this event is prophesied in the Old Testament. We see this like in Isaiah 53, talking about the suffering servant. Okay, and then also Cephas, I pointed out, because it wasn't common that they would have used, Cephas is Peter, and they would have used Peter's Greek name. Cephas is his Aramaic name. But they believe it's an Aramaic creed, meaning that the disciples would have been speaking in Aramaic right around Christ's time. By the time the Bible gets written, or the New Testament, the area is Hellenized enough that we get it in Greek. Okay, and especially Paul going to the world, the Gentile world, you get a lot of Greek written. Okay, but originally the creed would have been in Aramaic, so they kept the Cephas in Aramaic. Another thing I understand, and I don't speak Aramaic, I understand Greek, but in Aramaic they say this flows even more smoothly than it does in English or Greek, because it's an Aramaic saying and it has kind of a rhyme to it. Okay, and that's kind of how they did it. They call them mnemonic devices, and that's where you say something so it flows, because this was an oral society, and they would speak in creeds so that it was easy to remember things. Okay, and so there was a lot of reasons to believe that this is a creed, and again, most scholars believe it is, skeptic or not. They believe this is a creed. It just makes sense. Okay, now we go on to the rest of the passage, and Paul adds more information to the creed. But it is believed that this is the only section that was the original creed. So then Paul goes on and say, "Then he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at one time, most whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as though to one born at the wrong time, he appeared to me also. For I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God, I am what I am, and his grace to me has not been in vain. In fact, I worked harder than all of them, yet not I, but the grace of God with me. Whether then it was I or they, this is the way we preach, and this is the way you believe. That last statement is very important, because it's saying that this is what was preached. This is the way. This is it. This was what was preached, and it was death, burial, resurrection, and appearances. Those were the four things that we saw. This creed, early creed, is what was preached. We're going to go on to figure out how early this creed goes. But it tells us the testimony that the apostles and Paul died for, because he's saying right here, this is what we preached. This was it. So then let's go on to look back at this creed as far as how it fits into history. So 1 Corinthians 15:3, the first part, he says, "For I passed on to you." Okay, so Paul writes 1 Corinthians in about AD 55, 25 years outside of the resurrection. But that's not what he's saying here. He says, "I passed on to you." Who did he pass it on to? He's writing to the Corinthians. Well, he had visited the Corinthians back in about 51. So in about 51, "I passed on to you the creed." Okay? Then he goes, "As of first importance, what I also received." Okay, so I passed it on, I wrote it in 55, I passed it on in 51, but when did he receive it? That is the question of the day. When did Paul receive the creed? Well, it tells us in Galatians, I think, what happened. Galatians 1:18 says, Then after three years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas, Peter again, right, and get information from him. Now, I put that in blue because information, now that's the Greek word down there for information, which is isteresai, and it means that it's an inquiry to find out. It's been used like as an investigator reporter would use that word, to inquire. So Paul, in Galatians here, goes up to see Peter and James to inquire about their story, about their interaction with Christ, including the resurrection. He says, "And I stayed there for 15 days, but I saw none other apostles except James and the brother." Now, the reason we believe that this is when it happened is this is the first time, this was 3 years after he's saved, but 2 years after the resurrection. So Paul gets saved 2 years after the resurrection. 3 years later, he goes up to Jerusalem. He writes about it in Galatians, and meets with James and Peter. And again, this is a position held by most scholars that this indeed is what happened. This is where Paul got this creed that he talked about. He says, "Where he said, that's what I already received, and I'm giving it to you." So then if we look at it and try to just lay it out, and in case it was a little confusing how I put it, is let's look at this chart where it shows us kind of the resurrection creed as far as it's... And again, what is the creed at the top? Death, burial, resurrection, appearances. So Paul writes the creed in 1 Corinthians 15, AD 55, about 25 years outside of the resurrection. Paul passed the creed on to the Corinthians in Corinth in about AD 51, 21 years after the resurrection. But Paul received the creed all the way back shortly after his conversion, when he goes up to Jerusalem, meets with Peter and James, because that's when it would have all made sense as to when it would have happened. Only 5 years outside of the crucifixion. And Paul is saved only 2 years. So when you think about that, Paul got this creed only 5 years outside of the resurrection. Well, when was the creed formulated? Because Paul didn't formulate the creed. He received it. So somebody else formulated. Now, who would have formulated it? The apostles, which is why it makes sense that he got the creed when he went up to Jerusalem and met with James and Peter. So it makes sense that the apostles, immediately after the resurrection, formulated the creed that we see in 1 Corinthians 15, and that that represents the message that was preached immediately after the resurrection took place. The reason that is so significant to understand is that the skeptics say, well, we don't know that, a legend developed over time. A legend did not develop over a year. Right after the events, they say that legends take 50 to 100 years or more to develop. This is a creed that we can track all the way back almost to the event itself. These guys immediately formulated a statement. This is our statement of faith. This is what we believe. This is what happened. So I thought it would be good if, since next week is Resurrection Sunday, that we might just say this creed together. And I added "I believe" to it, since it is a creed. So I'm going to read it, and why don't we just all say this together? I believe that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. I believe that took place. I really do. I when I was looking at this, it's been a little while, it struck me just how there's no answer. If you anybody have an answer to this? I'm not going to get any hands because you're embarrassed, but if you think you do, talk to me. I would like to discuss it. I keep looking for holes. Like, is there some hole in this argument? Again, when I put this argument along with the fact that we have the 12 willing to die for their faith, Paul, not just willing, but they did die, Paul dying for his faith, Paul living a life where he is persecuted throughout his life, and then you see what he has to say, I have no reason to think for a minute that Paul could have been lying. I don't see, Jason. So we usually have some sort of altar call, they call it. and I don't normally do that, but we should probably, I say we should, what's that? Oh, do we do the offering too? We could do that now. I'll talk first. Let me just finish and then we'll end up that way. You know, if this makes sense to you and you've been struggling with, okay, you know, something brought all of us here tonight, and if for some reason you're at a point in your life where you're maybe not quite over the edge, but you have to admit that there is a very good argument being made for the resurrection, and you would like to discuss that more, you would like to talk about it, I really ask, please talk to me or a friend. Talk to me, actually. Forget the friend. Talk to me, please. If you refuse to talk to me, then go ahead and talk to a friend. But I really would appreciate it if you would talk to me, and I won't try to force anything, but just, I'd like to just talk about it, because to me, it's the reason to live. It's the reason, because it gives us, that we have an eternity that we get to live with a God who loves us, and it's based on understanding the truth of this message. And so, please, talk to me if you have any question about it.